his serenity, to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership, and we are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Okay, it's customary to say a few words about the Cook's Forest thing. But before that, let's just do some readings. Could I have the 12 steps read? This is from Kara from the Murraysville.
Been a Hearst. And I really want to thank you for the rides to and from. Actually, I got to thank him ahead. I got to leave at 4 a.m. in the morning. And he's got to get up to take me. And thank you, Dan, for having me. And it's always good to see my friend Ron, and great to see your family and what we saw the other night. And I got to tell you that Clark and Maria and Uncle Roy here have really shown us around town. I mean, you really have. And it's been ever so interesting getting to know you guys. And I had a great time listening to Harold last night. He sends his best. He said the wedding went great. But somebody, a deer, hit the car that picked him up last night, just so you know that. Yeah. Oh, love Marty and Cecil. Absolutely have had a great time. Had a great time with you guys. Oh, let's see here. I'm an alcoholic. It's the most important thing I can tell you about myself. My sobriety date is January 21st. 1987. Oh, by the way, I got prayed up by three of the most beautiful women in the room. We had Kim and Ann and Margo prayed me up earlier. Now, I don't know whether they're praying for me or praying for you. Not really sure yet. So, my sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. The most important thing I can tell you about myself is the fact that I'm an alcoholic. There is all sorts of things that I can tell you about things that I think is important, things about my life, but there's no other defining feature about who I am that defines me more than the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. I've got a really bizarre relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm an alcoholic. And this strange relationship, and strange is really, strange and bizarre are an understatement. And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink booze is what they refer to as the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It's really weird. It happens with nothing else. An example of that, they gave me this nice bottle of water. Over the next 45 minutes to 4 hours that I'm talking with you, I will, you think I'm kidding. I will probably drink half this bottle, I don't know, my mouth gets dry, I might finish this whole bottle of water. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish this bottle of water, I am not gonna go get a case of water and lock myself in the motel room. Right? There's no chance at 3 a.m. I'm gonna be calling up Cecil. Cecil, come on. I need another case. I'll turn the pink slip in my car. Come on. Right? There's no chance of that happening. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical reaction, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, no. Right? And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. I just hit my glasses. Right. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. You see, of and by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that is able to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink, no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. And it never, and I mean never, enters into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. I could care less. Sooner or later, my mind is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So therefore, I cannot drink successfully because of this bizarre physical reaction that I get, but at the very same time, I cannot not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Because I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, I would. Well, I just lied for the first time. I have no interest in drinking successfully. Do you? Because drinking successfully means two drinks and stopping. That just makes me nervous. And that's why medical science is always off base. I know we're polite in our book and say, you know, medical science may one day accomplish this, making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic, but they are missing the mark on thinking that we want to be a normal drinker. I have absolutely no interest in normal drinking. You see, for medical science to address what I got, the only thing they could come up with is they would say, if they came up with this, it might interest me. Carl, take this pill, and you can drink for 4 days straight. You can snort as much cocaine, smoke as much pot as you want, and nobody goes to jail. Nobody goes to the hospital, and your mother will still be very proud of you. Now, that would turn my head. I'd go, well, now let's talk now. I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more because it's the one thing, bar none, we all have in common. Because actually, we actually have a lot of things, if you really look at Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, there's a lot of things that we don't have in common because we are a huge, wide cross-section of society. Right? If you travel the world at all or even just travel the United States, you will see we are a huge, wide cross-section of society. Every single race, creed, color, religion, it just does not matter. Every single educational level, every type of family, I mean, really, we're all here. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only society where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all right here in the same room. And they're all telling a very different story about what just happened. So our stories are different based upon that, if you're listening. But you know what? We also drink differently than each other. If you listen closely to people when they tell their stories, you will see we drink differently than each other. And to illustrate that, let's say we wheeled right into the middle of this room and open up these doors, and on a giant cart, we wheeled in a giant cart full of all the kinds of booze we all love. If you're a top shelf expensive drinker, we got it. Remy Martin, Cavassier, we got it. If you're a bottom shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020. And everything in between, I know, some people just started salivating, Mad Dog, right? Right? And we wheeled it in here and we all took a good 4 or 5 stiff drinks. I mean real drinks. No umbrellas, no mixer. I mean good 4 or 5, you know, good stiff drinks. We would all be acting very differently, right? Over in this corner, some of it, we would have the good time crowd, right? The people that get 4 drinks in, ha, 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 fun, fun, fun. Talk, 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 woohoo, talk, talk, fun, fun, fun. Add a little methamphetamine, talk a little faster, talk, 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 right? But the people are having a good time in this corner. Over in this corner, we got the sobbers, you know, they get a little drunk and like, over in this corner, we got the fighters, you know them. Over in this corner, a bunch of us would be naked. I personally would be visiting each corner trying to find a couple of friends to come over here with me. Just the way I am. So our stories are different based upon which corner we're in, right? In the good time crowd, they get a lot of DUIs. They're always out driving, getting arrested on the road, right? Hey, next bar, who's after hours? Who's picking up the booze? We're going to Fred's house, right? They're out there. So they get arrested a lot. Over in the sobbing corner, they don't get arrested. They don't even leave the damn house. It says, the worst thing they do is they call you at 2 a.m. Or God forbid these days, drunk Facebooking. Right? Over in the fighting corner, their stories always have probation, parole, mom paying the bail bondsman, attorneys, court dates, right? That's their story. Over in this corner, children show up by surprise. That'll change your life, drunk or sober. Just like that it will. So our stories are different based upon which corner we're in, right? But no matter which corner we're in, there's one thing we would all be doing. We'd all be back at that cart for another drink. And it was really important for me to understand that when I was new and trying to listen to identify an Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm supposed to be listening to what happens to you when you drink, and then what happens to you when on your own you try not to drink. Because if you're talking about that, I don't care what race, creed, color, religion you are. You're me, I'm you. I set this relationship up that I just described to you right from the get-go when I first started drinking. I started drinking very late than most people in AA. I was 11. That's actually very late these days. We lived in Seattle by this time. I was born in Helena, Montana, spent most of my childhood in Southeast Asia. And then by this time, I got to Seattle when I was 10. And by seventh grade, a typical morning for me in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall thing, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property. Loser's Corner, every school's got a Loser's Corner. It's about 10 feet off of the school property. It's kind of like the way AA is treating the smokers these days, farther and farther away. You got to walk down the block now. I'd be out there at 7 in the morning smoking cigarettes, trying to look cool with these other kids. And we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever you could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before. That jar is very scary because nobody's been to bartending school yet. You know, and you're in a big hurry when you're ripping off the parents' liquor cabinet. You're not sitting there measuring a Harvey Wallbang or anything. I mean, you're just throwing it in. So you got cream de menthe, vermouth, and whiskey and vodka all in the same jar. You can imagine 7 or 8 of us, 11, 12-year-olds, handing that jar around, choking it down. Of course, it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. It was even before Ziploc baggies were invented, when it would just be a regular Glad sandwich bag, and as you'd roll it up, there'd be like 9 people spit on it, go, oh, man. Were you guys there, too? Yeah, that's why you're here. Quick commercial break. It's at this point that many people that speak in meetings often interrupt themselves and they say something like, I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are part of my story. I understand what they're trying to do, and they're trying to protect singleness of purpose. Vitally important aspect, no doubt about it. But I still think it's bizarre for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. See, I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and people that may still love us, but I don't know why we apologize to each other, for God's sake. So by the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm the neighborhood drunk, I'm the neighborhood pot dealer, I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. Yeah. He didn't find anything funny about this. And they saw something was wrong with me by this time. I mean, it was obvious. By the time I'm 14, my hair is down onto my shoulders, and my vocabulary is, whoa. What? Whoa. Right? That's my vocabulary. But my parents didn't understand I was alcoholic. They blamed my problems on people, places, and things. They always thought if we can get them away from that group of kids, things get better. You get them out of that public school system, things get better. They tried all of the above. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, places, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, places, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. By the time I was almost 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle after getting kicked out of the private school system, and my parents decided that Seattle is the problem. Get them out of Seattle, things will get better. They sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and in that 3 years, I got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, about a 0.25. I did nothing at that school. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran, I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being very kind. Long story short, it really would take till breakfast to describe everything involved in this next thing I'm going to say, and it really just, it's not worth all the blow-by-blow pieces here, but I just like to sum it up with, a really bad night happened, so I joined the Navy. It was that bad of a night. What I'm about to tell you should concern you if you care anything about the security of the United States. But on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test. And this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that even maybe possibly or even remotely allows somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. Never knew how to pass those things. I should have been kicked out right then and there through a series of events. I was allowed to stay in the Navy. And they took away that nuclear status thing. Thank God for you guys. And a year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. It's kind of like this. I knew I was in the Navy. It was obvious, for God's sake. I mean, I would look at my surroundings on any given day. It was obvious I was in the Navy. I mean, I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I'm on a big gray ship. By God, I'm in a uniform. No doubt about it, I am in the United States Navy. However, that ship would pull into a port, and I would take a drink, and I literally would forget that I'm in the Navy. And there's something else happening at this point in my life. At this point in my life, I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old. And when I take a drink, I am triggering off three-day drunks now. I knew how to go on three-day runs before as a teenager in my early 20s. Now, I am triggering these drunks by accident, and I am going into blackouts that are lasting more than a full day. And I got to tell you, it's a strange feeling coming out of one of those three-day blackouts, standing in a, on a large pier at 6 a.m. in a foreign country going, there was a destroyer here the other day. Navy frowns on that behavior. I've been in the Navy approximately 2 years, and I came out of another one of those three-day drunks, and I was in a place that I always was drinking in, and I was late getting back to the ship on a Monday morning, and I was in my car, it was held together by rubber bands, and by now one of the tools for living that I had gained is that at the end of one of those three-day drunks, I always tried to save a pint, and I would drink half that pint on my way into the ship. I'd keep the other half a pint underneath my seat. So at noontime on that Monday, I could run back out to my car and drink the other half a pint, my way of sliding into Tuesday. And this particular morning, I guess I was paying more attention to that, trying to get that half a pint in me than where the car was going. And all of it, there was this long straightaway, and at the front of every Navy base, there's a guard shack where a Marine stands duty. And under normal circumstances, you're supposed to slowly and politely pull your car up to that guard shack. And you show the Marine who's on duty your military ID. He will check the sticker on your car. If everything's in order, he will allow you to proceed onto the base. As I said, I guess I was paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me than where the car was going. All of a sudden, my eyes came into focus, and I saw the Marine's head was out of the guard shack. And I was wondering what he was so excited about till I looked down, and I'm still going 40 miles an hour. And I yanked the wheel. I tried to swerve. The car hit this median on the right-hand side and flipped over and bang, right through that guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive and a somersault. Back up, weapon drawn. Thank God those guys are in good shape. And it was just a nightmare that morning. The Navy was really angry. The Marine was all right. They're patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries, and they're reading new charges on me, and this is nothing significant in my life. New charges, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. So there's nothing significant about new charges, but the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called antabuse for me. I was now under order to show up at sick bay every single morning before quarters, and they would make me sit there and stick my tongue out. And the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning and baffling and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism. That is, I had no alcohol or drugs in my system, and I was literally going insane. See, I had felt this off and on throughout since I'd been 15, 16 years old. And throughout my life, my parents had sent me to some of the best psychiatrists and psychologists in Seattle. They used all their contacts they had, and they had many contacts in Seattle to try to find out what's the matter with me. Now the military has been sending me to psychiatrists and psychologists, and I never was able to verbalize this thing that I had been feeling and did not know how to tell anybody. And that is, I know it looks like the drinking is the problem. I know, I agree with you. The price for my drinking is getting high. I'm not happy the car is on fire either. I'm with you on that. I agree with your astonishment. But there was something that if I could have said it to them, I would have said, but if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. There's only one thing worse than the price I'm paying for my drinking, and that's the way I feel when I'm not drinking. And I don't know how to tell that to anybody, no matter how well-meaning they are. And I remember counting those days on that antabuse, just it's been 4 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes. And I'm on antabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion. We're really doing it. Only with love and tolerance in Pennsylvania, I'm sure. On the 10th day, I just snapped and I went AWOL from my ship. I locked myself in this little hotel room in downtown San Diego, Plaza Hotel. It's on 4th and Broadway. This would have been May of 1986. In May of 1986, the Plaza Hotel cost $13 a night. I have checked. They have rehabbed that whole area of downtown San Diego, and the Plaza Hotel is still there. It is now $19 a night. Check the Yelp reviews. It's quite interesting. So I locked myself in a little hotel room, and I got a bottle of vodka and a shot glass, and I remember sitting on the edge of the bed, and the bottle of vodka and the shot glass are there, and on this rickety little end table. And I remember staring at the bottle, and as I stared at the bottle, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of antabuse. They had told me, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this antabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle, and I thought, well, wonder which reaction I'm going to get. I took one shot, and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are kind of sick if you think this is funny. I actually have proof of that. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. I'm going to come back to the hotel room. Important things happen in that hotel room. But I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor was another guy on my ship, and his sponsor was a real, so my grand sponsor was a real stickler about the ninth step. And one of the amends I was unable to make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for that bachelor's degree. Remember that? I didn't have one. So when I got out of the Navy, that's what I did. I used some VA benefits, went back to school. And I took this business telecommunications bachelor's program. And in the first couple of semesters, I had to take a business presentation class, like a speech class for, you guessed it, giving business presentations. And in the first couple of days of the speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students one at a time, throwing them up in front of the room, giving them a topic to talk on, and then each student that was thrown up there was supposed to talk for 90 seconds or 4 minutes on whatever the topic was. So after about seven or eight students were thrown up, the instructor pointed at me. And I walked up to the front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor shouted out, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of antabuse. They did not respond the way you guys did. They were like, there were a couple of guys in the back going, "Woohoo, party!" So I'm back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced, I'm hyperventilating, I'm sweating, and I took another shot. And up it came. My late sponsor, my second sponsor, was a man named Eddie Cochran, who got sober in 1951. In fact, the same year this conference started, if he lived, he would have celebrated 66 years this December. Really one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. And he called the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I'm unfamiliar with. Because we all know normal puking, right? It's one of the tools for living we get. You're out there in the middle of a drunk, and you get the warning. Little sour taste in the back of the throat. Maybe a little bit comes up in the mouth, but we go, And we all know, based upon experience, we have 30 to 60 seconds to find a bathroom if there happens to be one. If we're driving, we've learned our lesson. Get the window down, right? If you blow it all over the dashboard, it's weeks before the smell leaves. But we get the warning, right? But here on the antabuse, no warning. Just, sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room as the bed. It's a design feature, I believe. Maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of antabuse, and that is that if I hang in there, and it's an important feature of drinking on top of antabuse, you cannot half measure it. You need to dig deep for a level of commitment here. That if I were to hang in there and keep drinking and keep puking and keep drinking and keep puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the antabuse would kick out of my system and I'd quit throwing up, and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm pretty much right with that. So I drank on top of Anbu's the last 7 months of my drinking. There's no other words to describe this other than desperation drinking. Oh, look at you. Oh, feeling so sorry for me. I actually feel sorry for people who have never experienced this. It's one of those life experiences that really enrich it, really. My second and my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in an area of San Diego called National City. Last thing I remember is lots of fists were flying. They were not mine. And next thing I knew is I came to and I'm on an operating table. Now, we all also, one of the things we gain in experience is that when we come out of blackouts, we have learned to start looking at our surroundings. Is it my room? Do I know where I'm at? And we gauge it for good night or bad night, right? When you come to and you're on an operating table, that, no doubt about it, bad night. Now, I also, it's getting very close that I'm coming to meet you people, and one of the first things I noticed when I met you is that you guys were talking about blackouts in a way that was frustrating me, because you guys were often saying, I am just so grateful to be sober, because I now wake up instead of coming to. When I was drinking, it was just horrible. I would come to and look next to me, and oh, as if you were always the good-looking one. I mean, there's two sides to this story. Because I had been experiencing coming out of a blackout, and every once in a while I'd look next to me and go, oh, I've always liked her. And, but she would wake up and go, oh, not Carl, no! And I'm like... My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail, and I'm being transferred from civilian authorities back to military authorities. There's a process that they go through for that. And I'm in handcuffs, and people in uniforms around, and nobody's happy. Neck muscles are not working well. And they tried to bring me back to my ship, and that morning the officer deck put his arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser, and the orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there that morning in handcuffs, apparently some sort of option was thrown out on the table. Now, I do not remember that morning thinking, oh, God, you're so good to a bum like me. I just can't keep going. I don't remember that. Nor do I remember, and it would have been more likely that I would have thought, hey, if I just act like I want that treatment thing, maybe I can beat this rat. That would have been more likely. But I now know that it would not have mattered what I was thinking or feeling that morning because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience with handcuffs, but my experience with handcuffs was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on this matter? Right? When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And they took me up to this military treatment center up in the north end of San Diego, and when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off me. And that is what the society I lived in and the country I was supposed to be serving felt about how Carl Morris was acting out there in the world without Alcoholics Anonymous. They were willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors are locked behind me, and rightfully so. So I'm going to do, apparently I'm going to be going through this 45-day treatment thing. And over the next couple of days, men and women from various different ships, bases, and commands from around the world were showing up. And in the first few days, they were doing medical checkups. They were asking what ship, base, or command we were from, and they would try to get our files transferred over. And they were doing group therapy. And in the middle of these group therapy sessions, they had this facilitator who I think he was new at his job, and he was giving us his best. I mean, he was trying so hard. And he had the big whiteboard with, you know, the progression of alcoholism, and he was trying to get us to talk. And none of us are talking. We're just arms folded, looking down at the ground. And he did his best, but he was getting more frustrated. Nobody's talking. And it wasn't until, like, late in the third day that this one fellow from in the treatment group raised his hand. His name was Paco. He was from some other base somewhere. And he raised his hand. I'd like to say something. And the facilitator said, well, oh, yes, Paco, what would you like to say? And Paco said, I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to do this staying sober thing. And I want you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a name I've always used whenever things look like trouble. And the other day when I got here, this looked like trouble. But you're going to be getting my file any day anyway, and you'll find out that my real name is Randy. Will you call me Randy from now on? Now, all of us kind of go, all right, whatever, nice to meet you, Randy. But this facilitator got really excited and said, oh, my God, that's the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you. Later that afternoon, we were all called back into that same room, and the facilitator said, Randy. And Randy stood up and come forward. And Randy came up, and they had this gold name tag that said Randy on it. And they slapped it on his chest, and then we were all informed that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. And Randy loved his new job. And we all hated Randy. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. To my knowledge, I had not run across you people. All I remember, we'd been in this place 7 days. And over the 1MC, it's like an intercom system through the barracks. It said, civilian clothes, parking lot, 6 p.m. And we all went out there, and about five white vans pulled up, and some guy with a clipboard started naming five or six names into each van, and each van took off into San Diego County, each one to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the van I was in, sure enough, pulled up at one of your meetings, and we sat along the back. If you go to San Diego, you can still see the military. We sit right along the back. I'm so grateful that the Alcoholics Anonymous in San Diego is wide open to the military and lets us sit right there in the back and watch you guys. They don't drill us as to whether we really belong there. They're open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They just welcome us and say hi. And we sit there and we watched Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, right from the get-go, I understand people that rejected Alcoholics Anonymous and had strange and funny interactions with you at first. But I got to tell you, I was floored by you guys. Now, I don't know whether it was a combination of that I was surrendered, maybe drinking on top of Anabuse for 7 months surrenders you a little bit, maybe gets you a little open-minded, maybe. Or maybe it was also a combination that the people at those meetings took their responsibility at the podium seriously and were carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. But you hit me between the eyes right off the bat. I remember getting this overwhelming feeling of, oh my God, they know. They know. And I started looking around, are you guys hearing this? And you guys seemed like it was just another Tuesday. Now, if you would have seen me sitting there going, oh, and you would have said, so kid, what is it that you know that you think they know? I would have gone, I don't know, but they know. And what was happening to me was what I believe Alcoholics Anonymous wants to happen to any new person, and that is I was identifying. And I was identifying with two things. I was identifying with the way you were describing your drinking, and I was identifying with the way you were describing the way you were feeling when you were not drinking. Next night, they took us to another meeting, and as much as I identified at the first meeting, I got very confused at the second meeting, because I don't hear this very much anymore, but back in the 80s, I heard it a lot. And this very second meeting, I heard it. Somebody was going, my drug of choice is, and somebody else was saying, well, my drug of choice is, and I'm sitting in the back going, oh, for Christ's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? So the next morning, I'm back at the treatment center. I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us. Her name was Mary. I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they're talking about something called a drug of choice. What do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. And that kind of startled me. And I didn't know what was... When she said play a game, I knew that she was really saying, listen very closely, Carl. Now, that was difficult to listen closely because I'm sure most of us have been in detox, and they give you that cup of pills. And when you take that cup of pills, it's hard to listen because there's these little, your field of vision is about fine right here. But they're dancing squiggly things over here, and you go, like that, and now it's over here, right? So when the white van pulls up at your home group and they're doing a little dance like that, that's what's happening. So when she said, Carl, let's play a game, I went, okay, she said, imagine this. We'll figure out where your drug of choice is. Imagine I came into the room, Carl, and I had a tray. And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately. Ha, 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 ha. I take them all. And she started to snap her fingers. Settle down. Settle down. You can't have them all, Carl. Play the game. Play the game. Pay attention. Which one would you take? And I thought for a second, I said, well, if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? And I said, no. She said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of here, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. I would now have enough money for a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. Now, there's only one reason I bring that up, and that is to discuss a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's sobriety dates. There's only one sobriety date. You ever run across somebody new and, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And you ever hear this? Oh, well, my drinking sobriety is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long. No. There's only one sobriety date. And it should be written in stone so that nobody can question it, especially us in the middle of the night. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety date, same scenario, saw this guy around my home group, hey, good to see you, how long do you got? And he said, well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I was like, I almost had to call my sponsor. I think that kind of falls into the same category as being down in Mexico, looking at the tequila going, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes. Sobriety dates are international. Just a little information for the new guy. So after 45 days, they let us all out of this treatment center, just what the orders were, and they're going to let us out on a Friday. And on the Wednesday before that Friday, they gathered all 35 of us up, and they put us in this room. The biggest, meanest counselor in the place walked in the side room, and we're all sitting here, chat. And when we saw him, it just went quiet. He's a Marine. That day, he's in his full dress uniform. I got to tell you that a Marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive, it gets your attention. It's an intimidating sight. And he opened up the door that day, and the whole room went, and he walked up to the front. You could hear his shoes as he clicked across the tile floor, and he came up to a podium like this, leaned across, and stared at us. It felt like forever. It was probably 30 seconds. Then he finally spoke. He said, you 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. This treatment center has been here for many, many years. And over the years, the statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? Then he said, many of you relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back into long-term sobriety, but the statistics of this treatment center say that only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Man, if you thought it was quiet before he said that, you could hear a pin drop in the room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here. He's like the poster boy of the treatment center by now. So on this Friday afternoon, they're letting us all out, and people are being taken back to their ships, bases, and commands in various different ways. And there was four or five of us that were informed, because we'd been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown into this place, we were informed that our vehicles had been in an impound lot for the last 45 days, and that we were to stand on the front doorstep of the treatment center, and our vehicle would be brought out to us one at a time. So I'm standing there with three or four other guys, we're looking at each other, sea bags at our feet, and all of a sudden, one of the guys that I'm standing there with goes, is that Randy in that car? And there's a car coming towards us. And one of the other guys says, he's drinking already. Sure enough, Randy's got a bottle. He's polishing it off. Ah, rolls right in front of us, rolls down the window, goes, ha, 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 throws the empty right at our feet, crash. We look up, he gives us all the finger, and he drives right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember of that day is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not know where else to go. I showed up at the 6 p.m. gong show in Pacific Beach in the north end of San Diego, and I'm sitting in the back of this meeting, and I do not know anybody in that room, and the truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink. I have a lot of information, and I'm physically feeling better than I have felt since a young teenager. But there was no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And what was more dangerous than that is I did not know I needed one. Which way is my life going to go? If there's ever a turning point in my life, it was right there that night. My life is hanging in the balance. One guy that night operated on his primary purpose. I'm sure there are many other men that were operating on their primary purpose. This guy, for some, I know the reason, I'll tell you in a minute, was lurking through the back of the meeting hall. And he came up to me and said, hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing? He startled me, and he caught me off guard, and I accidentally told him the truth. I would have lied if I would have given him just one more second. But I accidentally told him the truth and said, I don't know, man, I just got out of a Navy treatment center a couple hours ago. I don't know what I'm doing. This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. He looked like he had just hit the jackpot in Vegas. At the break of the meeting, he started fighting his friends off. He's mine, my newcomer, mine! I didn't know you mark your newcomers around here, for God's sake. But there was something going on in this man's life that particular Friday night that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. I know. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend, homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman, flat out insane. In between this barrage of meetings he dragged me to, he'd throw me in the passenger side of his car, he'd start driving, and he wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that had made it to the next meeting, I guess. And he'd be yelling at me, gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, you gotta get sponsored. Damn her! Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book. And he's like spitting on me. I'm like, oh man. Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup. But I'm so glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was the guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore, he understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I am so glad that that guy, that night in his pain, was not at home underneath his covers, whining into his sponsor's answer machine. If you are 25 years old or younger, an answer machine is this box that used to sit on the kitchen counter. So glad he was not whining into his sponsor's answer machine, sponsor, fix me, give me the golden answer. I was so glad he was out dragging my sorry butt around. I was just a prop in his weekend so he didn't do something really stupid. I'm glad I was of service to him. But by going to so many meetings in the same area of town, I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new. I saw other people that were going to multiple meetings over that weekend. Now, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy. But I saw other people that were at two or three meetings over that weekend. And what I learned that weekend about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. You guys have a football team around here, don't you? I thought so. I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up. They make a plan and they do one play. Then they huddle up again, they make another plan and they do one play. It's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the game around here is one day without a drink, you're a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. And we go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this and we try a little of that and we run right back in here. Huddle up. After that weekend, I got back to my ship, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. I was 25 years old. He was 23 years old. He had 14 more months than me. He became my first sponsor, and he was absolutely the perfect sponsor for me at the time. I'm so grateful that the one other sober guy on my ship was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't have to change a single thing about what he was doing in his life in order to facilitate helping save mine. All he had to do to help save my life was stick his hand out and say, come do what I'm doing. That's a valuable way of life. We often forget it though, don't we? A few years in here and we go, really, another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh my God, that old timer's telling that same story again. I remember the first time I accidentally said that around my grand sponsor. I'm sitting there with my sponsor, right? I'm 25, my sponsor's 23. He's 14 more months than me. His sponsor was like this old man with like 56 years old with like 28 years of sobriety. And I'm sitting there and we're in a meeting and the old timer starts telling a story that I'd heard the same thing about 10 days ago. And I whisper to my sponsor, he's telling the same story again. Oh my God. And my sponsor reaches past my sponsor and hits me in the back of the head. Bang! He goes, he's not talking to you tonight.
He's talking to the new person that apparently you're unaware is in the meeting. And I literally had this experience of, oh, there's other people in AA besides me. That was a huge... And some of these things that you hear again and again have profound impacts on new people. The first time I ever heard somebody, and if you've been here a while, you've heard it 1,000 times, but the first time I heard, if you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk, I had a minor spiritual awakening. I remember hearing them going, if I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. I stayed sober for 4 days thinking about that. You could have seen me outside the AA clubhouse. If I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. If I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. Now, little warning, don't call the non-alcoholic people that love you and try to impress them with the things you're hearing in AA. I called up my mother and I said, Mom, you wouldn't believe it. I just learned if I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. There was silence on the other end of the line. After about 10 seconds, she said, bunch of philosophers there in that AA program, huh? I got back to my ship. First 6 months of my sobriety, meeting, and I was running around hoping you would say something funny, clever, insightful to put a Band-Aid on something I could not even put a name on. And I was running around in Alcoholics Anonymous with the untreated alcoholism. 6 months, 7 months sober, approximately, somewhere around there, ship had to go out to sea for an extended period of time. My first sponsor, Bob, told me, meet me in the battery shop in engine room number 2 every night at 6:30 p.m. And I showed up there at 6:30, and he showed up with that blue book. He tossed it down on that table, and he said, I've been hounding about it for months. Have you read it? And I said something like, well, yeah, there's like how it works. We antagonists. Some doctor has an opinion about something. Stage 2 of him saving my life, he opened up that book and started to read, and when he was tired, I would read. And he shared, remember, he's only 14 months ahead of me, he shared what little he knew. Maybe his sponsor had just taught it to him last month. It was beautiful the way Marty was talking about staying one page ahead. And he had never worked with anybody, he was no expert. And I look back at this next few months out there in the middle of the ocean as Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. It was two men, the blind leading the blind, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, way in this battery shop on the USS Cushing, DD-985. Two men trying to have an experience with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Neither one knew what that experience would be, but we both had it. That man died sober. In 2008, he was still 14 months ahead of me. And I got to tell you, that man's life was that thing that got me to stay here. Don't ever deny the value of what you're doing in AA. We have no idea who we're going to affect. During the same period of time, I learned something really valuable. And that is that if we have found this solution and we're reasonably and properly armed with facts about ourselves, we have a responsibility to show up and take our seat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's this magic thing that happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous that does not happen anywhere else, and that's one alcoholic sharing with another. One alcoholic can get another alcoholic to do some things that nobody else can. And how I learned that, I'll never forget. My first sponsor, Bob, and I would often split a hotel room. Whenever the ship would pull into a port, we would split a hotel room, and then we'd go out and try to find the AA meetings in that town. This particular time, we're in Victoria, British Columbia. We got a hotel room, went to the AA clubhouse. After the meeting, Bob said, God, I'm not feeling too good. I'm going to head back to the room. And I stayed out with the AAers for a while, maybe went to another meeting, out to coffee, I don't know. But an hour and a half later or so, I come back to the hotel room, and Bob had found this other guy from our ship named Blair on the street, literally half passed out and with vomit all over him. And Bob had carried him back to our hotel room and put him on our bed, on my bed. Right? Not our bed, my bed. Does go on in the Navy, but not that. And I look at this, and Blair's, and Bob is sitting there with his big book open saying, we are more than 100 men and women that have, and I look at this scene, it's ridiculous. I mean, Blair's like, doesn't even know where he's at, but Bob is sitting there reading the big book to him. And I think this is a waste of time, but I throw my 10 cents in, and then we carry Blair back to the ship, and we get him back into his rack so he's safe. And last we hear of Blair for weeks. Weeks and weeks later, we're back in Port in San Diego. It's 3 a.m. I'm in my rack on the ship, and all of a sudden, and they pull back the curtain. There's Bob. Bob says, Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. We got to go get him. If you aren't familiar with the Coronado Bridge in San Diego, it's a very popular suicide spot. Such a popular suicide spot that they actually have suicide hotline phones about every 100 yards, just in case you change your mind, right? They're hoping you're still on the bridge when you change your mind. And Blair was apparently up there, and Blair was apparently saying this to the suicide hotline counselor on the other end, very well-meaning, highly educated suicide hotline counselor. Blair was saying, I will only talk to Bob W. Suicide hotline counselor was saying, who's Bob W? Blair was saying, it's anonymous. So she goes and gets her boss, another well-meaning suicide hotline counselor. They start doing the good cop, bad cop, firing questions at him, confusing him, find out he's from the Navy and what ship he's from. So they just take a stab in the dark, and they call down to the quarterdeck of the ship at 3 a.m. in the morning. They go, do you guys got a Bob W on that ship? Now, my first sponsor, Bob, would guard your anonymity at the level of the ship, but he did not guard his own, so he could be of service at any time. So therefore, the guy that answered the phone said, yeah, Mr. 12 Steps, we know all about him. So they go down and get Bob. Bob comes and gets me, and we get into Bob's car, start driving to the Coronado Bridge, and as we're driving, Bob says, Carl, get the big book out of the glove box. Bone up on working with others. Like, all right. Says, see your man alone if possible, Bob. He says, oh, forget it. We're going to wing it tonight. We get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and everything that San Diego County has available for a situation like this is there. The on-duty police are there. The fire department is there. The paramedics are there. The on-duty psychologist is there. And Bob and I start walking up, and the fireman who seems to be in charge looks at us and says, is one of you Bob W.? And Bob goes, yeah, that's me. He goes, I don't know what you're going to do. We've been talking for an hour and a half, and he ain't budging, but here, go ahead. Talk to him. They've got this contraption wired up. So Bob goes, Blair, and you can hear on the other end, Bob, is that you? Bob goes, yes, Blair, it's me. Now get the hell down from that bridge. Here. Okay. One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no one else can. Don't forget that. We take our seats in our home group, and we do what Alcoholics Anonymous asks us, even when it's convenient, especially when it's inconvenient. If it's not inconvenient, I hate to tell you, it's not a commitment. 2 years sober, I got out of the Navy, packed my car up, headed up to Los Angeles to go to school. I told you all about that. Through having to make amends, I still was push-starting the same car I got sober in, 68 Volkswagen, hole in the floor, but I'm puttering on up the L.A. freeways with everything I own in that car, and I'm thinking, I'm 2 years sober, I'm fresh out of the Navy, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to be working, I'm going to be busy, I'm not going to have much chance to go to meetings, I got to get a life. I've heard people talk about having a life in AA, I'm going to get one. And the nice cars were driving by, and they'd honk at me, and it kept on saying, like, loser, loser. I pulled into this town called Covina, and I decided I'll find out where the meeting hall is so that I will know where there's a meeting if I need one, but I need to get a life. And once I get a life, I'll try to get active again, but literally, I was about ready to make a fatal, fatal decision. And the man making coffee, my first sponsor, Bob, had 2 more years in the Navy, and the ship was going to Asia. I wasn't under the idea that I needed a new sponsor. I had lost that idea, and during that 2-hour drive up LA freeways, I was really off track. And I just, one last gasp of a thought was, find where there's an AA meeting so I'll know where it's at while I'm going to get my life. And the man making coffee that day walked over to me, had this medallion that it's circle and triangle, said 1951. I knew what that meant. That meant he was 10 years sober when I was born, for God's sake. And he came over to me, he said the very same thing that man had said to me fresh out of treatment. He said, hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing? Now, this time I had a much better answer. I said, sir, it's very nice to meet you. It's nice to see your meeting hall. I'm 2 years sober. I'm fresh out of the Navy. You won't see me very often. I'm going to be going to school. I'm going to be working. I need to get a life. I really need to get a life. You might see me once in a while, but, you know, I'm going to be busy. And if you knew Eddie, he had this laugh. Where he said, oh, son, school and work are wonderful, but that's what we do in between meetings, son. And what he was really saying to me, and it's one of the most important pieces of information I've ever been given in Alcoholics Anonymous from another man, and what he was really saying is, son, you need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. The first thing he told me what I needed to do was put new guys in my car. I objected for a second. Hey, I've got a hole in the floor, but I got to push start the thing. He said, put new guys in your car, your life will get better. I didn't see how that was going to happen, but he was 10 years sober when I was born, so I did it. The very first night I followed his direction, my life got better. The new guys could push start my car. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. I got to tell you, in the 30 years that I've been here with you people, I have found a meaning to life and a purpose to life that I never knew existed for a guy like me. 17 years sober, I got married. We have two beautiful kids. Beautiful, beautiful. They are 10 and 13 years old. Their names are Madison and Ryan. The marriage did not work out. I know you've never heard of that in AA. But I got to tell you, she is a very good mother. And she and I had an important task. Right? My son was 11 months old and my daughter was 3 years old when we got divorced. We had to work this out. And we both love those kids from the depths of our soul. And we had to both realize that we cannot act and react on the threat, what the perceived threat of that love for those kids. And we had to work this out. And we had this house up at the golf course. We split it into two townhouses that are about 8 minutes apart. And the kids go back and forth. And we work together as best we can. I love the way Marty said it to me the other day. In the business of raising kids. That's what I've been doing for the last 13 years. And I got to tell you, I have found a level of love for another human being from those kids that I never have felt ever in my life. I've loved other people. But not like that. It's like I've met who I will die for. I know when I raised my hand, the Navy made me say I would die for you. I was really hoping it was not going to come to that. But like my kids, it's not even, it's just a natural, whatever I need to do, it's like I would die for. And I love other people in AA. I really, really do. I mean, Clark, I've just been hanging out with you. I love you. I really do. Rick, I mean, Ron, I love you. I never need to know their name. But I do. I love you guys. But I got to tell you, if we're out at Starbucks later and some guy comes in with a gun saying, when you got to die, I would say, have you met Ron and Clark? I ain't kidding. But with my kids, I wouldn't even give it a second thought. I would never trade my kids for the first drink. However, I'm alcoholic. I know what it means to be alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink like that. So there is nothing that is more important than me staying in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are new and you don't know what I mean by saying the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, it means you're not in it. You need to find the center. There are hundreds of people here that know how to guide you to the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I find it to be such a privilege when you guys ask me to come and do this task of Alcoholics Anonymous than doing what I'm doing tonight, because it's inconvenient. It really is. I would rather be home with my kids and doing what dads are supposed to do. But I know that I don't have a chance of being a good father without doing what you guys are asking me to do. And it's also such a privilege to be asked, because right now this weekend there are like probably 8 or 10 amazing things happening around the country and the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. 8 or 10 amazing things, and this is probably the best thing happening this weekend. And I get to be here, right? Because you guys, I mean, how can I complain about that? This is like a huge hotbed of Alcoholics Anonymous happening right here in this beautiful forest. Guard this thing you guys have. Whoever the young guys, you need to learn how to guard this thing the way they have guarded it. Because this is a valuable, valuable thing. People's lives change. It's not an automatic, oh, but you know what? Each piece of the puzzle is just as important as that guy that came to me the first night I was out of treatment, and he just took that simple action and changed the course of my life. And those things happen every day, all the time. God bless. Have a great weekend.